Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. This week, Vince McMahon told us that the world title isn't important, it's the millennials' fault that nobody is a star, and that he didn't mean to fire CM Punk on his wedding day. Personally, I think Punk should FedEx Vince a few of those Z-Packs to help with this fecal overload.
I'm G. John Chase, and all I'm going to say about 95 is... Mantar. Mantar.
I'm Carl Jones, and in 1995, WWF Creative was still throwing shit at the wall and marketing things to children, much like present day. Also in 1995, Paul Orndorff was showing Vader that sandals are no indication of a man's toughness. And finally, the Yeti was exposing the nation to dry humping not seen since the days of Debbie visiting Dallas.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. Since last week's show, I've been giving a lot of thought to how I could become the reincarnation of Andy Kaufman. For instance, I too will wrestle women, and my finishing move is going to be the camel toe clutch. It's kind of like the mandible claw. Just a lot more fun.
This is the panel for the 22nd Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the Monday Night War in 1995 next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 22nd Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Welcome to the Action Zone.
Carl Jones.
There was no action on the Action Zone.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Alright.
And we are here today with a very interesting discussion. One that I've actually been looking forward to for quite a few weeks now as we've been kind of tinkering with this idea in our heads. Obviously there's a lot of coverage on the Monday Night War in history, but to me, and to the guys on this table, I hope I speak for all of you, the first 4 months of the Monday Night War in 1995 are kind of the lost months of the Monday Night War. These are the ones that don't get that much coverage, and there's so many details that I find this period of time absolutely fascinating, just that, yeah, the changes in the business, what this would lead to going in. We've got a lot to give you here today. We've got timeline of events that we're going to go through, starting from the very inception of the show and how it came to be. I'd like to credit Dave Meltzer and the Wrestling Observer Newsletter for the notes that I've cherry-picked throughout the year of 1995 to read on this show. And we've also got your thoughts as well about the Monday Night War, what was happening in 1995 in general, high points, low points, you name it. So we're going to get to this right now. There's so much to get to. We're going to talk about pre-Monday Night War in 95. We've got a few comments here that I want to read before we get into our individual thoughts around the table, because I think these are quite representative. Monster Heel from F4W Online. I cut my teeth on WCW because it's what my grandfather watched, and that's how I got started in 1994. I discovered WWF on my own, though, and I liked it more. 95 WCW seems caught in between the old sports-oriented promotion that WCW was pre-Hogan, and then trying to copy the WWF. Hogan and the Dungeon of Doom stuff was horrible to me, even as a kid who primarily cheered for the babyfaces. I enjoyed the actual matches, but the backstage stuff was too much for me. They went too far into cartoon territory. WWF was a product for kids then, but it wasn't really a cartoon as much as it was your toys coming to life and having matches. So just thoughts around the table here in general, because the Dungeon of Doom and WCW, we can talk of this in broad strokes right now, because we're going to get to more detail as Raw and Nitro begins. But 1995, rough year, rough start.
Yeah, it's a good first email, that one. I think summed up WCW from my point of view as well. It's the split between the two. I think we've said loads of times before. I was, like yourself, was a WWF fan at heart. Growing up, that's what I was first indoctrinated into before already witnessing much of WCW. Just was like WWF light. It was horrible. Hogan, Savage was still great at this time. He can still go, but he was still, you know, he was Hogan's little buddy.
Yeah.
Sting, marginalised, you know, he was great. Flair, you know, again, I think a lot is said about calling these old guys at the time, and the image, obviously, with the new generation WWF. But for me, they weren't actually, like, you look back now, they don't seem that old. But old as in the characters were kind of had run the course, they were from a different era. And so half of WCW was basically WWF light from back in the day, just playing catch up with wackier names like Shark and VK Wall Street. Whereas WWF, yeah, the undercard was still this wacky, colourful, neon tights. It's just guys who just, even at a young age, I didn't care about, apart from the guys who were more serious and a bit more exciting, like Shawn and Brett. So good shape, really, for them.
Yeah, there's a little bit more here before we actually get to any more additional thoughts from Mifune Jackson from the Wrestling Forum, who actually had a hell of a lot of fun comments. In the WWF, even before I knew what was going on, I could see my favourite wrestler Bret Hart being marginalised by Diesel and Shawn on TV at a time when he really should have been the champion. I had to watch Diesel versus Mabel and HBK versus Razor in a redundant second ladder match while Bret Hart was facing Isaac fucking Yankum at SummerSlam. I also didn't really understand why Lex Luger, after being built up for so long, was being marginalised. Meanwhile, I was kind of pulling for WCW and the Hogan experiment to work out. But things like Uncensored 95 and Hogan's failure to put Vader over really started bumming me out. I didn't really care about Savage and Flair feuding again. Overall, the whole league seemed like it was trying too hard to be the WWF in 1987, to your point, Kieran. Renegade and the Giant were a good metaphor for the company as a whole. They were trying to be cheap imitations of things that once worked.
I understand completely what he's saying there about Brett. I think Brett alluded to it himself, didn't he, in his own book, the way he felt like he was just, you know, it was almost like the championship was just the extra piece of luggage for him that just asking him to hold it at times.
Or towards the end of the year.
Yeah. The thing is, I just look at 95 in general terms and just think absolute dross.
Let's go home, then.
I think
that just showed, folks.
And not wanting to be glib about it, but I look back and think, you know, you got Man Mountain Rock opening up the Royal Rumble, which is the worst Royal Rumble in company history.
I think 93 gives it a go.
But that had Brett Razor.
True.
Which was decent. Mabel winning King of the Ring. Ugh. The email there's already alluded to, obviously, Hogan jobbing out Vader. You've got Hogan's dark side.
We'll get to this.
Which I'm sure we'll get to in greater detail later on. But yeah, you look back on 95 and I think I'll look back on it with a lot of regret.
There's something interesting here I want to touch on, because obviously we sent feedback out for what were your viewing experiences at the time, and we got a hell of a lot more feedback than I was actually anticipating of people who actually didn't see 1995, which again kind of plays into why I wanted to do this show, because these are kind of, like I said, the lost month of the Monday Night War. XL from TPWW Forum says, I stopped watching in 95. I kept up to date through the WWF magazine up to about Survivor Series before I stopped following the product entirely until 1998. I believe ITV had stopped showing WCW worldwide by this point, and not having Sky meant I couldn't watch either brand. Bad News Gunn from TBWW also says that WCW was only on very late in syndication up in Canada, so WCW was hardly on my radar. Power Butchie from the UK fan forum, just to go back to the worldwide point, I don't really know about it because we didn't get Nitro. As far as I was concerned, Worldwide was number one, and Cobra and Frank Anderson were the future. And then Worldwide, which was seemingly a bit behind anyway, was taken off the air, so I didn't have a clue. As regards to any war in 1995, I was completely in the dark due to the problems with TV and the Aptamags being about 10 millennia out of date. Nitro highlights on the version of Worldwide we received were super rare. I can't hardly remember any footage out of the odd Hulk Hogan sand stash part of his career. I didn't have a war as media coverage when all shite, as I wasn't buying Power Slam yet, being 10 and all. Don't think I was even aware of one until 96.
I wasn't watching wrestling at this point in time. So
you fall into the category of a lot of people who get feedback in.
Which is why I'm going to chime in now, because the main thing I remember from about 95, because even though I wasn't watching the product, was actually a lack of presence, actually, in terms of like the general popularity, I guess.
Mainstream profile,
exactly, yeah, because to the point where when I did get back into wrestling in 98, when a friend pointed out to me, my first reaction was, wow, that's still going.
Really?
That's actually still around. Wrestling's still around, because I hadn't heard a single thing. The last sticker book I got was from 93, I think. The figures I hadn't seen since freaking like 92 either. I didn't see any computer games, arcade games.
Oh, you really missed out on in your house.
Oh yeah. I mean, in terms of just like the general merchandise, which is generally like how when you look at WWE today, is how they hawk their, you know, their fame around the world. There was just none of that in 95, and it goes even more with WCW, where it was just the only thing I did have for WCW was on Saturday afternoons, and that was completely disappeared as well. I don't know where it went. So, you know, I just kind of gave up on wrestling.
Edgar the Slouch from the UK fan forum. I was 15 when Nitro started. I never really felt like it was a war for a good 12 to 18 months after that, partially because my only exposure to WCW had been on Worldwide and ITV during 93. Also, barring me picking it up illegally from my next door neighbours, I never had Sky until February 96. My only way of keeping up to date was Power Slam and buying the pay-per-views on VHS. Sounds very, very familiar to me and you.
Yeah, I think especially from the UK perspective, was Nitro on, was it DSF or something, the German channels?
They were kind of like Saturday night and shows like that on DSF, and actually I do want to tie that in here because there's a fantastic comment from Wyatt Sheepmask from the UK fan forum. Only really had access to WCW on Saturday nights when the parents went out. Never got to see Nitro when the Cartoon Network switched to TNT. That would become in 1996. DSF showing WCW pay-per-views, then over to Vox on Channel 37 for a bit of softcore blue was the usual routine. The view
Even, brother!
The view last channel on our glass Sky remote meant covering your porn viewing tracks became a military exercise. I don't know what that had to do with anything, but I thought it had to be read. So yeah, to your point, Kieran.
Ah, the 90s, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I'll say that the Yeti running was far more crass and vulgar than any snuff film I've ever seen.
Oh God!
Just to your
and
point,
hairy.
just to your point, though, Kieran, you're right. Again, we didn't have access to Nitro in 1995. It came in March of 96. That's when we first got it. So yeah, DSF was the only reach we had, and even then, it was, you know, well, it was in German. So what can you do?
Yeah, and to bear, this is probably more significant. Say, obviously, from the UK, to generalise, most of us would have been viewing things from the WWF side, and WWF up until the Billionaire Ted skits didn't address them, so it was like the war being fought overtly on the one side kind of thing, which we weren't privy to. So but at the end of the day, it's probably irrelevant because the war was fought on US on the base of US reigns,
exactly.
So exposure in the rest of the world probably is a bit insignificant at this point in time, maybe.
We're going to get to the timeline here because there's a lot to get to. We're going to start off from the very, very beginning. Let's just backtrack here. WWF did get one bit of good television news. This is from the Wrestling Observer newsletter at the beginning of June. They got one bit of good television news over the past week when the ratings came in for the May 29th Monday Night Raw show, headlined by Undertaker and Jeff Jarrett, which set the all-time record for the show with a 3.9 rating.
Jesus.
They'd love that today, wouldn't they, huh?
Bring back Big Daddy, that's something. Yeah. was that
the only time Jeff Jarrett ever got big ratings?
I who knows? We will find out as we explore the timeline. However, a very innocuous line from the Wrestling Observer newsletter that day: Ted Turner met with Eric Bischoff on June 5th in Atlanta. No word on anything that came out of that meeting. It would obviously become a big story in the June 19th Observer. WCW will be adding a new television show every Monday night, going head up with Monday Night Raw on the TNT cable network starting August 7th. The idea for the show stemmed from the Bischoff-Turner meeting and was released to the WCW front office on June 8th. Reports we received is that obviously the time slot is no coincidence and stemmed from Turner being personally miffed by the letters Vince McMahon was sending him earlier this year, urging him to fold WCW, claiming the wrestling company was an embarrassment to Turner's name. Wow. That's what happens when you spank the big dog, Vince.
That's Vince playing the old wars from the mid to late 80s back again.
It really is. Trying to play Billy Big Balls, and this one ultimately would do him no favours, as it turns out.
Yeah, but Vince was the innocent victim in all this.
Because
this is completely different to the territory days.
Absolutely.
Vince wasn't trying to kill the opposition.
No.
Vince was just trying to help his own product.
Yeah.
Ted just wanted to kill Vince.
Just ask Vern. There have already been reports floating around that the new show will be titled Head to Head, but I'm told the decision on the title of the new show won't be made until later this week. Still better than Late Night Appetite that the WWE ever had. So making no bones about what this really is all about, Head to Head. Moving on to the June 26th Observer, one week later. Little trivia note here. Nancy Sullivan was given a tryout as an announcer this past week for the new show, but the only word we've gotten is to expect Eric Bischoff to host and for the show to have a totally new look. It is expected that the show will be done similar to Raw in that 3 weeks will be taped at a time, with the first week airing live. Wouldn't take long for that to change. Within the industry, the general consensus is this move is almost suicidal, going head up with the highest rated wrestling show in the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's logic. At the time, many thought it was going to be split the audience and no one was going to benefit. Maybe the perception it's going to be a war of attrition from WCW, and they're just going to run them down, underestimate the tribal nature of wrestling fans, maybe.
Yeah, that's an interesting tidbit from Meltzer in the Observer there, because it's, whilst he's acknowledged that, and I've seen old footage from people like Heyman at the time thinking that the WWF was just going to cannibalise Nitro, to Kieran's point, and some of them even acknowledge this on that, remember the story of the Monday Night Wars DVD they did a few years back?
Oh, yeah.
There were people like Bruce Pritchard and one or two other sort of talking heads on there who acknowledged their fears that they didn't necessarily believe that they were going to dominate from the start. They were really concerned about that split in the audience.
Yeah, and rightfully so, as we'll get to. Just to get some of the feedback here, Haphazard from F4W. When WCW announced they were doing a Monday night show up against Raw, I thought they were absolute lunatics. The first few shows felt strange, WCW giving away dream matches on TV with next to no build-up, and the value of these matches was diminished as a result, but it did get results for them in the short term. Again, just kind of echoing the sentiments there, and we'll get to some of his other points later on as we go through the timeline. But a lot of people, again, had to have that belief that this was, you know, again, a 3.9... a couple of weeks prior to this announcement being made, so you can think a lot of trepidation should have been going on in the WCW offices, but as it turns out, not so much.
The one thing I just want to say to that is, it did, eventually, one company did die out of it.
Oh, yeah.
And it lost its ass. and maybe that was always an inevitability. I think we talked about it in previous weeks.
This is the trial of Eric Bischoff. You mentioned it. As soon as, your theory was, as soon as they actually went head-to-head in that kind of environment, one was always doomed to fail.
Yeah, and maybe it's a matter of time. Yep. So that'd be not maybe to, everyone was right. Maybe so.
I don't want to jump too much. Much to I think Kieran was right when he said that. But I just think it was more a case of the individuals at the time who thought that one company would die out, sort of envisaged it happening a lot quicker than it did.
Yeah, that's true.
We go into the June 3rd Observer here. The debut of the as-yet-unnamed Monday Night Primetime television show has been pushed back from August 7th to September the 4th, my birthday. The first show will go unopposed by Raw, which is preempted that week by the US Open Tennis Tournament. No word on the first show, although it has become no secret that WCW is attempting to work through New Japan to debut several hot workers on that show, including attempting to put together a singles match with two of these three: Sabu, Eddie Guerrero, and Al Snow.
One of them doesn't belong.
Wow.
None of whom would be on that first Nitro.
Yeah, well, again, well, I guess...
In
video form, Sabu would appear, I suppose. Though, again, we'll get to all of this, because things change very, very quickly. But, again, interesting they ended up selecting a night where Raw would be preempted, which would play into their hands quite nicely.
Was it tennis, or was it the dog show?
I thought it was the Westminster dog show.
Yeah. Monday Night Raw on July the 3rd did a 2.7 rating, which ended their four-month streak of being over 3.0 every week. It was called the most successful quarter-year period in the history of Raw up to that point. But I think this is actually kind of an interesting point to tie into, because we kind of briefly touched in broad strokes how 995 was a pretty shitty year for the WWF. The run with Diesel and Sid, and then Diesel and Mabel, the interest was kind of falling. I've always thought that WCW, I mean, this came at a very opportune time to have this head-to-head competition, because this was the WWF's nadir, creatively speaking.
Yeah, it's incredibly stale. You've got to think that that they've got people such as Chris Candido, excellent workers who are debuting as fitness gurus. You got the likes of Aldo Montoya and that sort of thing. And the WWF's just a company that clearly hasn't evolved.
Yeah.
Now, WCW's tact wasn't necessarily the right way to go about it by trying to tap into former glories from the WWF, don't get me wrong. But there's certainly, there is that root in there, if you like. You saw sort of a counter-revolution with ECW to an extent, and there was definitely, it was sort of fertile ground if you had the right product to jump in. I think everyone could see that at the time.
I think it's pretty interesting too, again, one of the reasons why, there's another little tidbit here that we'll get to, that need that Bischoff felt to kind of shore up the card with more talented people. They were going head to head. I guess he knew in his own mind, in some respect, we need to juice this thing up.
I think he was probably following his own. It was the typical Vince line now about segments of the audience and trying to cater for different segments. Bischoff was probably doing it before Vince was doing it in many respects.
Neither company was actually doing well when it comes through a character and talent perspective. They're actually very similar at this point, because whilst they had like a handful of guys who you could who you thought were very kind of real, shall I say, they had very real personas and they were good wrestlers. Yeah, both sides, they had a lot of shit and a lot of bad characters in there, which we've already mentioned probably a few already.
A lot of misfires.
And there'll be a lot of misfires.
Characters, they're like caricatures, man.
Yeah, that's what was bad.
The thing, it's all, just to jump in quickly, sorry, Chess, it's just that I think the caricature line is excellent, because WF was still just this cartoon. And the earlier emailer mentioned it, that it wasn't so much a cartoon as the figures you used to play with coming
to life.
I'm paraphrasing a bit there. I appreciate that. But I think that's semantics to me, to be honest. To me, that's sort of very much one in the same.
The only thing I'd say, actually, that's probably in WCW's benefit in late 95, is the fact that they had the backing of Ted Turner. Ted Turner is already on board, and he's willing to give them everything they want, which is where we get Nitro from. So it's like Eric Bischoff had, I guess, a little bit more in the back pocket than Vince McMahon did.
That's one thing that is going to be very interesting to document, how much Ted Turner was on their side, because this might wake a few people up, actually, some of these facts. Kevin Sullivan officially replaces Ric Flair as the head booker of World Championship Wrestling after a meeting on July the 5th. Since Sullivan's wife has been a fixture with ECW for some time, and Sullivan used to work there and is familiar with the talent, there's a lot of talk that he'll try and shore up the undercard with some of the ECW wrestlers. Several names have been bandied about over the past week as being considered, among them the Headhunters, Public Enemy, Eddie Guerrero, Al Snow, Shane Douglas, Chris Benoit, Woman. July 17th, the new show is now tentatively named WCW Power. Power Hour. Are you ready? Rumour has it that WCW's first Monday night taping is going to come from the Paramount in Madison Square Garden. So there's a little trivia note as well. Oh, they actually wanted to go into WF's hometown and piss on their wall.
Shot, isn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, eventually that did not come to pass, but that was their original idea. July 24th, Observer. The first TNT show is now going to be called something like Wrestling Nitro. Again, to that point about how much Ted Turner was back in this, it's believed that WCW will be getting $38,000 per week from the TNT network for the Monday show, far less than the $100,000 per week to cover the costs that WCW thought it was getting when the show was first announced. There is no way that will even cover expenses of a taping if they are to be competitive with Raw. That's the equivalent of just under $2 million a year in funds they were getting for Nitro.
Yeah, but I would be a little sceptical about the logistics of that, because
I'm not saying it stayed being, that way.
Being on, as Carl said, with the infrastructure of Turner in general, there would have been avenues and available to WCW which wouldn't have gone on the books as, you know, profit loss. So there is that to bear in mind.
Yeah, so. And actually that does tie in later, but it's just an interesting note right here that you know, people have the impression, like you mentioned, Ted Turner could do whatever he wanted. That's actually not the case, and there's more examples of that to come.
Some of those figures there don't actually surprise me that much, because I think like a lot of American TV in general actually works like that. They're not going to throw the entire budget at a new show, which they don't know whether it's actually going to fully fly, you know, to the extent when it's going to be like prime time, as opposed to the previous deals I've had before. So I'm not actually surprised that they only got a fraction of what they're thinking.
Assuming that number is accurate as a sort of, you know, a base point for the company and for the launch, it does surprise me, because it's always worth remembering that although you mentioned about profit and loss and Turner running a business, he never treated the wrestling side as business. It was his own personal toy, and if nickels and cents alone was the key factor, as we've covered in other podcasts, WCW would have closed down long before getting to the stage of Nitro.
This is an interesting one here, because this is a real marking point here in the state of 1995 wrestling. The realities are starting to come to roost in this episode of The Observer. World Championship Wrestling's efforts to bring in quality workers to boost the proposed Monday night television show seems to be evaporating like water in a heat wave. Two of the original names proposed to come in, Al Snow and Eddie Guerrero, appear to have fallen through. WCW had wanted Snow, Guerrero, Benoit, Sabu, and possibly Dean Malenko to up the work rate of their new show, which goes head-to-head with Monday Night Raw on September 4th. At this point, they've accomplished getting none of the above, because it appears the company won't be offering any newcomers contracts, and in fact is constantly looking for ways to cut the payroll.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and there's more details on what was offered to Guerrero and Malenko coming as well, but this isn't just a WCW-exclusive situation. We've been talking a lot about that because we're talking about the creation of Nitro. Just to give an idea where the WWF is at the same time, 25 people cut from the front office this week. Jack Tunney, Stephanie Wyant, Tony Gurria, and Lord Alfred Hayes are given their marching orders. Also, Sione, Afa, Lou Albano, Duke the Dumpster Drosy, Mantar, the Heavenly Bodies, Techno Team 2000 are also canned. Doink, Dink, and King Kong Bundy are being phased out also. So a real cull here.
None of them were missed.
Yeah, apart from Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey, who we'll always love.
Well, he had some legal issues in California at the time.
Okay,
so he
probably, see ya.
Being a gigolo, those things are bound to happen.
What it's a test to, again, is the transitional period that was this 1995. WWF quitting guys, WCW desperately looking for new talent, whole business in a set of flux, even if they probably didn't know it so much at the time. So.
But I'm just wondering for your folks' intake on this. Although it's clear that they're desperately trying to get new talent on board, just, I know without sort of going down each and every individual name, just thinking about it generally, to me, I would think WCW had the better roster from an in-ring perspective before the war starts.
That's a tough one, man, because I don't know what WCW really had. They had Flair, who wasn't exactly on fire in 95. They had Savage, who was hit and miss. He was good in the Flair stuff. Yeah, Pillman, who was doing some good work in the mid-card. Johnny B. Badd kind of came into his own a little bit this year. Other than that...
So
Sting? Sting was good, yes. Yeah,
you've still got Arn.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing is for me, I'm not saying that they had a fantastic roster, don't get me wrong, but, you know, and Vader's still there.
Vader.
I'm not saying they had, you know, a roster that was the bee's knees or anything like that, but when you compare it to the WWF side, and you're basically saying, well, they've got Bret and Shawn.
And
Razor, and
if you want to look a little bit, they've got Bulldog, they've got Owen, they've got Kid, they've got Hakushi, they've got some decent guys.
But Hakushi was never used, and the Bulldog in 95.
Yeah, I know.
This is going to come across as blasphemy from an Englishman, I know, and it probably upset one or two English emails. But he was so gassed up. He was
so
moved.
Big in 95, I know. So I agree, 95 was not his prime year.
I suppose maybe to counter my own point after raising it, is that I guess it's this idea of a desire to appear fresh and new. It's the new kid on the block. And yeah. What better way to appear as the new kid than to have this talent that you have.
A lot of fresh faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. At this point, it is virtually a lock. The first TNT show will air from the Mall of America in Minneapolis.
Well, just a thought. So what did you make of the Mall of America then being the first
choice?
Location of Nitro?
And I'm not saying it would have been my first choice if it was my decision to make, but at least it's something a little bit different. And the WWF, for all the name recognition and the fact that, you know, it had done 3.9 earlier in the year, you know, this wasn't like sort of 97, 98, you know, going into 99 where they're doing Raws at MSG and that sort of thing. You know, that the sort of buildings they're running a much smaller scale than
live attendance was not great.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember that WrestleMania of that year was from the Hartford Civic Center.
I guess just for me, like when watching those that first show back, watching the couple of the matches that were on there, it always just strikes me as just being weird watching it. It reminded me a lot of when they started doing a lot of their recordings at Disney.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's just this thing where you're watching it and they're going, oh, welcome to the Mall of America and stuff like that. And you just seen, like, you know, they've got a group of people all around the ring and then you just seen a bunch of other people with their shopping on the escalators.
On the escalators,
just looking, going...
The escalators!
Yeah, just looking, going, what the fuck's going on down there? And it's just like... It's the same with the Disney Studios. Absolutely. Where you just got some people there. You got the kids cheering because they might know wrestling, or they might look, oh, this looks interesting. And the parents, which happens still today, the parents sat down next to them, not reacting, going, "What the fuck is this?"
And it's just people walking in the background. That's the thing for me.
It's weird.
When you see people walking, getting on with their lives. Your show should be the like they start the show and they do the helicopter shot. You show the city like this whole city's on standstill for our show. Then yeah. You actually show inside the show. Yeah. It's a free show in a shopping mall. You got people going up their escalators, going up to fucking Dixon's or whatever. It is. That drove me insane.
It's the lift, isn't it? Oh. There's a lift. The hard coming.
We'll get to the actual first night during the execution, mate. I'm glad that we got to that point now.
August... Well, I will say, it was in a mall. It was in a mall, and Lex Luger still came out with that shirt. Buy a different shirt!
August the 14th, Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Even more surprising than the WWF's decision to revamp the SummerSlam car because it looked horrible was the decision made this past week to hire Bill Watts as a television scriptwriter.
Oh.
Well, wait a minute. You read out there that they revamped the SummerSlam card.
Yeah.
If Mabel Diesel was part of the revamp, what the fuck was the first offering?
No, well, Diesel Mabel was the planned thing, and the card looked horrible because Sean Sid was going underneath, and they were just thinking, we've got these two lugs with the two top guys, what the hell are we going to do? So they added Kid and Hakushi to the card. They put Sean in there with a ladder match with Razor again to kind of... Because, again, you got to remember, this was coming off the fucking hideous King of the Ring pay-per-view, which was one of the worst shows in company history. So they were just thinking, we can't have another one like that. They were very aware that King of the Ring 95 sucked ass.
But Brett still had to suffer.
I hope there's people in WWE right now who still have nightmares over that King of the Ring. It's that fucking bad.
So we'll get, you know, Bill Watts in terms of a television script writer. He hadn't really been around since 92 in WCW, and even then he hadn't been around since the UWF went out of business, so this was a bit of a questionable call.
Well, it completely flies in the face of my suggestion earlier that the companies were looking for ways to recalibrate.
Yeah. Doesn't it? Because this is the age-old thing in wrestling. Everything gets recycled when you're desperate enough and need a new direction. There's always... Vince Russo, how many jobs? Vince fucking Russo has had more jobs after getting... Russo.
It's comical in the sense that my notion of recalibration, the idea is they're going to recalibrate by going to something that's possibly staler.
Yeah, going back to the 80s.
Speaking of, Mike Rotunda is coming to WCW, don't ask me why. The original idea was to hold a press conference to announce the new Monday Nitro show and bring him in at the press conference without saying so, pretending it's an interpromotional match and angle. So the blueprint for the NWO was always there in Bischoff's mind, and just imagine if IRS was the first member of the New World Order.
Well, I'm sure Uncle Ted didn't pay taxes at some point.
Was he VK Wall Street yet? Was that
he would become VK Wall Street. That's in the early stages of Nitro, yeah, and Bischoff's just looking for those digs. The first main event of Nitro is a bit of a trivia. It was supposed to be Hogan versus Mr. Wonderful, but they changed it. Terry Taylor buries Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero on the WCW hotline, saying they've never done anything in the wrestling business, so who are they to turn down WCW? They were offered 3-month non-guaranteed deals, which is why they turned it down.
At the end of the day, though, he was a company guy, and what do you expect? I mean, gives a fuck what he's got to say. You know? when people take the company approach, it's like, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Don't you ever, ever, ever defend the Red Rooster in my presence again.
What you can do about it, Rummy? Stagger off your chair and come windmilling at me. I don't think so. Okay. Just look at the landscape of the company. If you're those guys and you're getting off a 3-month no guaranteed contract, it's best you're glorified jobber contract, so yeah. Why would you go there and damage yourself on the national stage?
They both knew their value, which is the key.
Yeah. But particularly when they're getting a lot of hype from the ECW shows that they're doing as well.
That's true, and New Japan too. Things do change around here. We're about 3 weeks away from the beginning of Nitro. August 21st. After weeks of what appeared to be fruitless negotiations to bring in some of the top workers in the world for the premiere of Monday Nitro, WCW appears to have reached agreements with Chris Benoit, Sabu, Dean Malenko, and are expected to reach an agreement this week with Eddie Guerrero, all of whom should be debuting in September or October. It appears all four deals were helped put together by Masa Saito and the New Japan office, which is the primary group that all four have been working for and has the relationship with WCW. So they do eventually land what they were looking for. WCW held a press conference on August 14th at the Harley Davidson Cafe in New York, the same place the WWF held its WrestleMania press conference. This is again where they were going to do the IRS thing. Yeah. And instead they announced another bombshell, which is that Steve McMichael will be part of the broadcast team.
Longo.
Yeah. Longo is gonna extend his wit to all of us.
You know what? After watching some back of those shows, I really didn't hate that team.
Really?
compared to today,
yeah, I guess it's all right.
God damn, Bischoff's all right, you know?
You mean compared to Tenay and Taz?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm so good.
August 27th, we alluded to it in the intro, Vader and Paul Orndorff get into a fight at center stage. WCW had counted on doing an angle on the very first Nitro to set up a surprise Hogan versus Vader WCW title match on September the 11th, the first head-to-head show. There was even some talk about Vader winning the title on that show to be the big jolt to get fans to think that Nitro was the show not to miss. But you can probably guess where that idea got vetoed along the way. The key here, if Vader was to be let go for disciplinary reasons and it would hold up legally to the point they wouldn't have to pay Vader off, it would open up an estimated $625,000 to $750,000 in annual salary. Keep that in mind for September the 4th.
Was it they said he was AWOL, hadn't filed the right papers?
Papers to do the War Games match, he was gone. Vader, who they bastardized him anyway. I mean, Hogan had jobbed him out. They did that hideous angle where he joined the Dungeon of Doom for 2 weeks. I'm sure no one remembers.
He must have couldn't wait to leave that company. I mean, just
Vader had a really cherry deal, like $750,000. He had that contract till 1999. That's a lot of money, and he lost it. He lost out on all of it.
Don't think he could have got that if he went back to Japan.
He was in Japan at the same time. That's why he had that. He was able to play every side. He was doing the UWF pay-per-views at the same time. He had a pretty good run of the place.
He's not leaving that money on the table if he's given the option. He was forced out.
He was forced out. Trust me, he was forced out.
He had been more or less bastardized by that point in the company, and it's not going to have the negative impact on business that it would have done in 93, when he was still very much an integral part before it had become the complete sort of, Hogan and Friends show.
So we've set the table, we've talked about the things that got us up to this point. September the 4th, the US Tennis Open. But more importantly, Nitro debuts. Bischoff, Heenan and Mongo do commentary. We have Brian Pillman and Jushin Liger, Ric Flair and Sting, Hogan and Big Bubba Rogers. And of course, the big thing here, obviously we mentioned the whole the Vader incident. Lex Luger is able to debut on this show because he has now signed his contract. The Luger deal had fallen apart a few weeks back when they were negotiating over money. Luger had given his notes to the WWF, but WCW was only willing to offer him $1,000 per night with no guarantee of a number of dates per year. But apparently the deal was put back together when the future of Vader became cloudy after the Orndorff brawl. Reports are that Luger signed a 2-year guaranteed deal with WCW. Quite interesting, because Bischoff's tried to intimate that Luger took a bad deal in order to come here, And it would appear that the live report, commentary says that's not the case.
Yeah, Bischoff has said this countless times that, you know, he. I think the most egregious he got with the figures would say, I think he earned a tenth of what he earned when he of what he yeah. when he left the first time,
which would be about $50,000.
Yeah, you know, creative accounting at its very best there. But yeah, it certainly suggests that it was ever so slightly different in terms of the cold hard cash that was coming Luger's way.
What was you guys' opinion on Luger's debut on that first show? Because again, watching this footage back after getting over the whole escalator incident, I don't know. I just felt that fell flat for me. I mean, I know this is in like retrospect, but just like watching it and how they presented it, and I just remember like the scene Luger walking out. As you said, in questionable attire and with questionable hairdo, even for mid-90s. And
Farrah Fawcett.
And just... he's definitely Charlie's Angels. But it's... just Sting and Flair just staring at him. He just walks out. He's not... They don't do this thing where, like, say, like with what they do with Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, where he came through the crowd as if he was, like, a WWF invader. He's just walking down the ramp, I guess, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, as Heenan said, it's a public mall.
Yeah, it's a public mall. Yeah, he's doing some shopping.
For shit.
Yeah, he probably was, yeah. I don't know. It's just... It just seemed like time stood still for a long period of time. Not in a good way. It's just like everyone's just staring at each other.
I actually quite liked it because it was subtle. It was... You know, he walks out and they don't mention him by name. They just it's him. He's here.
What is he doing?
Yeah,
here?
So he's like notorious. He's famous. The pause. I mean, it was a pause while the rest of the you see the live audience, especially near on the hard cam, they're still standing up. Whatever. Well, it's obvious to the TV audience who it is. So they're standing up, realizing what's going on. I didn't really have a problem with it. It was what was a bit weird is when he just then disappears.
Well, the crowd were probably taking ages because they were going, who the fuck's this guy?
Well, you can really see because, it's in a mall. It's not set for it.
Oh, yeah. They're probably all in the escalators.
Interesting point here. Mifune Jackson from the Wrestling Forum, who dropped some feedback early on, but I wanted to read this from him. Nitro was debuting as a free show at the Mall of America, which I live near, so I decided to go. I'd never been to a WCW show at all, so this was a great chance to see it. Not the best show, but matches like Pillman Liger and Sting Flair were entertaining. I didn't even see Luger the first time he came out due to where I was standing, to your point. But when I saw him come out at the end talking to Hogan, my mind was blown. Finally, something interesting happened in 1995!
Yeah, watching the show back, I mean, it's only 1 hour. A nice shock to the system, a short shot. That's why, obviously, Flair and Sting went on second, because it was only a 1 hour show.
Yeah.
I really like that match, the Sting match. It was just like every Sting-Flair match. From, Sting was no... no-selling is an art form in itself, and Sting-Flair, it's just fantastic. Liger, Pillman, probably good for the time, but it was sloppy.
It was sloppy. There's a hurricane run in there. That's quite questionable.
Yeah.
So he comes back... And he announces as selling it as in, you know who this guy is, as in he's the WWF guy. They were more advertising it as in, you know who that guy is, the guy from WWF, you know, the guy who had the failed run on top, as opposed to saying like, oh, you know who that is, that's Lex Luger, the guy who was here a few years ago and was like a big name and he's now come back.
See, I disagree. I think you're being too cerebral there. I don't think that they were trying to sell him as the WWF guy at all in the sense of that he's... You know, his WCW run we're ignoring. It was just to tie into that shock element of we weren't expecting this guy here because in theory he's not under contract to WCW. I think that's all that was. I think you're trying to. I think you're reaching a bit by suggesting they're trying to portray it as this is the WWF guy that he's so great in comparison to our inferior WCW guys.
I think it's just the fact that they don't actually mention him by name, which is why I'm thinking that.
Cause it's because it's the shock. It's because they're not expecting him. It's because he just turned up and they're thinking, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, and eventually they would, obviously, because he comes back towards the end of the show to do the face-to-face with Hogan, gets to the line about how I've spent years playing with kids, now I want to be here for the big boys. This belt that you're wearing, Hogan, is the only one that means anything, and next week we're going to have the match of the century, Luger versus Hogan on Nitro.
Yeah, and they mention his name. You know, as soon as they came back from commercial at the start of the Flair Sting match, it was only that initial when he came out. It's like when they the commentators are discombobulated a bit. Well, what's he doing it? That's all it was.
The game 666 is a funny name for you from the Wrestling Forum. Nitro really came off as a really big deal when it debuted and felt like a bigger deal than Raw did. Even though it had been done to death, Flair Sting on the first Nitro was pretty big, as was the shock debut of Luger in WCW after his WF run. So it did start off on a high. Whitey Ford from TBWW, pretty much the only points I remember from this period, are guys jumping ship back and forth, only thing that made me care about Nitro at all some weeks. So I guess that kind of ties into it. But again, that shock value of the guy showing up there, it was a big deal.
Yeah, it's as we said, this set the tone straight away of, of this unpredictability, and it's, you know, it's something intentional by Bischoff to create. When you're going head to head, you know, it's a must see show. Stuff's going to happen on his show. So straight off the bat, they were setting that tone.
I was just thinking, and solely with regards to the matches themselves, you've got to factor in this notion of the world title's being defended on TV, which was still rare then, you know, on something that's, you know, free TV. I don't know if it's cable, but you get the general idea. And the fact that it's Hogan wrestling on TV.
2.9 rating for the first Nitro, unopposed, of course. Anybody remember the other invading superstar?
Scott Norton.
Yeah, Scott Flash Norton debuts as this hot outsider. Randy Savage hits the ring to tease a match for next week, which, we'll get to that.
Wait, by the way, Savage was awesome in that segment.
He was great,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Watching that segment, that was feel like, this guy's got years left in him. Watching it, it's like he at that time had, he was, I think he came up with his black bandana on, and he looks a bit, and he looked edgier, yeah, but next week he was still in his neon colours. Like, if you just, again, head of the time, if you just roughed him up a bit, made it a bit more stone cold, if you want edge to him, Savage could have had loads of life. Yeah. Imagine if, like, they'd given him, like, the makeover treatment when they did Sting, and he had them two feuding with the NWO. Finally some baby faces with Sting, but alas,
not to be. September 11th, the first head-to-head, WCW wins, drawing a 2.5 rating as opposed to Monday Night Raw's 2.2. The number of people watching wrestling during that one-hour time slot was the largest for any one-hour segment since the Hogan-Flair match at The Clash last year, and the largest for any Monday night in years. Obviously, this is the Hogan-Luger match of the century. Sabu debuts in ECW against Alex Wright. Scott Norton, thanks for coming, does the job to Randy Savage. That's the end of him. And Raw runs with Razor versus Davey Boy Smith, with the whole Douglas Kidd involvement, if you remember that feud, and of course Shawn Michaels and Sid in the main event with the comment from Bischoff.
Was it Shawn beats the big guy with a super kick that wouldn't get you a green belt in the local YMCA?
Just again, just a dick move. Hogan Luger match of the century was used essentially just as a setup for War Games. Again, interesting treatment. The WWF acts like Nitro never existed. They edited any reference to Lex Luger off their TV over the weekend, whereas Nitro saw Bischoff gloating about Luger coming out of the Bush Leagues. Steve McMichael says, "Don't turn the channel to watch a show named after an uncooked egg," showing his true forte in the booth. And Mike Woodson to change his name to VK Wall Street. Yeah.
That's probably the peak of his commentary.
Apart from calling the brain the stain, I think.
Bobby the Stain. Thoughts on Sabu's debut?
Oh, yeah. It's like an addendum to our most disappointing show. Yeah, fuck you, Sabu. sloppy as hell. Alex Wright completely steals the show in that match for me. And that tail spot at the end, he should not let near the top rope again after that for me.
Yeah, not a good performance. The commentary did him no favours either by just fucking not, you know, doing him no justice. But the match itself as a performance, again, we'll get to Sabu a little bit more later on, but not a good first outing here.
Just on the point of the fact that it outdrew Raw.
Yeah, because that's the big story here. We've kind of glossed over.
Do you think that's a case of, it's sort of the lingering effects of the previous week, isn't it?
Oh, for sure.
And the fact that WCW have got this match they can tease, or they got a couple of matches if you want to, you know. You basically may as well say, and a wrestling appearance by Randy Savage, because no one gives a shit about Scott Norton. Raw's been preempted by the tennis, so no one knows what's going to be on Raw. No one's got this idea, and, you know, curiosity, I suppose, is only going to get you so far. If you've got guaranteed matches that you're going to get on the other side, you're probably naturally going to go and watch that.
Abe Knuckleball Schwartz from the UK Fan Forum. "I was actually in America when the second episode of Monday Nitro aired. I remember almost bribing my mum and dad so that we could go back to the hotel for 9 p.m. so I could watch. At the time, it almost felt as if I was cheating on the WWF. As in the UK at the time, we did not get any WCW programming, and the only way of keeping up was through Power Slam and WCW Magazine. WCW seemed so different to WWF at the time by giving out results on, by giving out the results to Raw. At the time, I could not imagine Vince even acknowledging WCW's existence." Well, he didn't. Let alone promoting their show on Raw. Big news, however. September 15th, the day that will live in infamy. Anybody remember why?
September
15th. WCW fires Steve Austin. Austin had been in the doghouse of WCW management over the past year with a reputation for not exactly keeping quiet with his discontent about how he was used. A few hours later, Gene Okerlund is given a raise in a move that a lot of people did not like backstage, because a lot of people connected the dots there. Okerlund was negotiating a new deal the same day that Austin got fired, so they're thinking that his money went to Okerlund. Obviously, that's not really the big issue.
With Austin, the Stone Cold character, came about from the fact he got fired. It was the fact that he got fired that pissed him off so much that he created that character, which gave him into success. If he had stayed in WCW, would he have realised that same success if given the opportunity?
Possibly not. And I understand what you're saying in terms of it's hard to look at Stunning Steve Austin, and you know, as much as I loved the Steve Austin stuff from back then and think it's criminally underrated in terms of how good a worker he was, when you go back and watch that stuff, he's fantastic. But it's hard to project onto that sort of canvas, if you like, what happened a few years later. I think what's more egregious about it all is the people that were quickly put above Austin. I think that's what I...
Like the Renegade.
Like the Renegade, like jobbing to Duggan in 18 seconds or whatever it was. You know, things like that are a bit harder to take than necessarily just saying, we don't think Austin's going to be the biggest draw in the history of wrestling. No one could have predicted that. But you can certainly say there's very little justification for bumping up the likes of Duggan at that stage, Renegade.
In one respect, you can it's understandable. I mean, you couldn't have predicted what Steve Austin becoming, you know, the Stone Cold success. It's, you know, impossible, no way. But at the same time, they were so desperate looking for talent, and they're just...
They had Steve Austin sitting there, they had Brian Pillman sitting there.
They had no aptitude or intent to really repackage guys like that. The only guys they seem to repackage are like the Booty Man and stuff, guys who they need an excuse almost to keep around. So on one hand, you've got, they were, you know, he was obviously looking at his budget, trying to, you know, cut and cost here.
Austin had a big contract.
Exactly. So you're looking at, that was a bigger factor that then has been really let on. So, you know, well, that's one thing, understandable.
Yeah.
But when you're looking for talent, it's kind of...
Well, that's the thing, again, that whole thing of looking for talent, the Eddie Guerrero, D-Michael, look what they were offered. In many ways, I think they were just looking for a cheaper version of what they already had in Steve Austin. And they probably didn't think that Austin had enough to be more than what they ended up doing with Guerrero, Malenko, Benoit anyway. Just to move on here, Fall Brawl takes place on September 17th. If anybody wants to mention this pay-per-view at all, it's really nothing to admit. The Dungeon of Doom main event is fucking hideous. Perhaps the worst
War Games of all time. With a camouflage attire.
Perhaps the worst War Games of all time.
I really enjoyed that on Ric Flair match. But for what it...
Dad winning a
big one. Yeah, it is. Dad wins with the DDT. Fantastic. I mean, what was there not to love? Brian Pillman interference.
Pillman to me was the star of the show.
Does that crazy kick on Flair.
Pillman and Bad had a really good match at the start of the show, which went like 30 minutes, which the story goes that they put them out there for that long thinking they were going to bomb just to shut them up, and then stealing the show. So that's quite an interesting thing.
Well, yeah.
And of course, Pillman gets involved in the angle, so he gets a huge boost on this show.
Because that was on my my WCW VHS set that I had, the Best of Fall Brawl that I had in 99. Yeah, I know. Hey, we were going on about how do we find WCW and watch it. This was how I watched
tapes,
WCW.
Baby,
it was tapes. It was the Best of Uncensored Fall Brawl, Great American Bash, and Bash the Breach. Yes, I know, Carl. Take a swig. It's okay. Jesus, pop another one.
Anyway, moving along to Monday Night Wars, we're here to discuss the next night. The reason I did mention Pillman is because they headline with Flair versus Brian Pillman. Raw wins 2.5 to 2.4. But some signs of hotshotting here, or the first title change of the Monday Night Wars, the American males beat Harlem Heat for the tag belts. Yeah, come on! Raw goes with Razor versus the 1-2-3 Kid, and Yokozuna, here's a dream match for you, Yoko and Owen versus Men on a Mission.
Oh.
A boring show, claims Dave Meltzer. That Sunday, In Your House 3, with a disgusting bait and switch finish, if you remember the triple header main event of Diesel and Sean against Yoko and Owen, Davy Boy, Owen, for all three belts, in which the babyfaces win, and then the title gets returned the next night. There's a speech prior to that show by Vince McMahon, saying that Bill Watts will take a larger responsibility for the creative end of the company from this point forward. A very anti-WCW speech, where he talks about how they're shooting themselves in the foot long term, but they can't afford to do Raw Live, so they won't. He said that if the company goes out of business, the only people he'd be interested in would be Sting, Harlem Heat, and Brian Pillman. The only creative changes people have talked about are a more soap opera-ish look to the TV shows, with, get this, a major push for a black baby face. That's a novel concept. It was obviously Ahmed Johnson's the guy that was in mind, and possibly another title reign for Bret Hart.
Well, it's Bill Watts 101, isn't it? You know, the African-American
straight
star.
Straight wrestling champion. The reason I mention the American Wales in the tag belts, because 1 week later, after that In Your House, WWF does the same thing. The Smoking Guns beat Owen and Yoko for the tag belts. So we start seeing these belts getting switched around to try and liven up these shows. Nitro runs with Luger, Meng, and Savage Sullivan, so...
Nothing. Well, you notice they're only doing it with the tag belts, because by that point the tag belts meant fucking nothing, because they didn't have any
teams.
Decent teams at that point, so who gives a crap?
From this, from the Observer from this week, supposedly Jimmy Hart ran into Ted Turner in an elevator during midweek, and Turner remarked to Hart words to the effect of, "We really kicked Vince's ass," which I guess tells people where the priorities lie here. The October 2nd Nitro they ran with Savage vs. Luger, Eddie Guerrero pinned Dean Malenko in 5 minutes, 27 seconds of a very good match, but the crowd was totally dead, which killed it. They cut away from this match to show Hogan arriving at the building, and the announcers spent more time talking about Hogan and ignored the match, a sign of things to come for the next 4 years. When it comes to the guys like Guerrero and Malenko,
it's just it's the commentary style in general. I think you can watch enough Raws from previous around the same time frame and going forward, where everything's about hyping up what the big stars are doing on that show, and not necessarily how great these guys are in the ring and what's currently on the screen. It's all just window dressing for what we're getting to. Stick with us. This is what's coming.
Yeah, it's again, it's kind of another bad habit picked up from this environment that's kind of stuck with us. To a degree. Desperate times call for desperate measures, and it was desperate within a month.
October 2nd, Nitro and Raw, to highlight the big angles here, Hogan's moustache is shaved by Kevin Sullivan, a dastardly act, to allow Hogan to film the Secret Agent Club, I believe.
Why do they stop a moustache?
Yeah, he should have shaved his head years
ago.
If you thought
Hogan looked like a douche before.
Raw's opposition here was Brett versus Jean-Pierre Lafitte, and an angle with Razor and the 1-2-3 Kid, where the Kid lost her 3 times in one show.
Yeah, about fucking time.
We pay that job, as G. John Chase laments. October 9th, episode of Nitro from the Rosemont Horizon. Hulk Hogan did an interview that everyone has been talking about since. Hulk Hogan was booed out the building. Yeah. So Gene Oakland went on about what a phenomenal reception he was getting, while you can hear Hogan sucks chants in the background. Hogan talked about the promoter in New York, whose ego was bigger than the entire business, and explained how he came, took all his friends to WCW, which is now number one. He then said how that promoter is now dying and choking on his own ego. The irony of this interview hasn't been lost on many. Fuck it, Hogan just, I don't know whether you want to say it's out of control or if he's speaking through Bischoff, whatever you want to say here, but this he's
projecting.
Yeah, but don't you think, again, it's interesting though, this is the first signs, not really the first signs, there were always traces of it, but Hogan being booed.
God bless Chicago.
They always had it right.
Had he done the black attire?
It's coming.
Yeah, okay.
It's coming. I think maybe as a reaction to this, as a matter of fact.
I thought they said that they tried to palm that off as an excuse at one point.
Oh, it's because he's wearing the black that he's getting the boos. Yeah, on versus Flair in a cage, headlines this episode of Nitro. Raw with a 6-man tag main event. Davey Boy, who just turned heel, with Yokozuna and Owen over Diesel, Shawn, and Taker. Davey Boy pins Diesel after Yoko drops a leg on him, so that's really heating up Davey Boy for their pay-per-view match. Yoko and Mabel kill the Undertaker in the ring, while Dean Douglas attacks Michaels in a very Mid-South angle. So you can see the Watts influence here, of a lot of things tying together and crossing over. After 4 weeks of head-to-head matchups, WCW has 2 wins, 1 draw, and 1 loss, which is a hell of a lot better than even the most optimistic WCW people would have predicted. Just for some more initial thoughts about the early days of Nitro here, from Slicky Tricky Damon from TPWW Forums. At the start, I usually caught the gist of Nitro by watching WCW Saturday Night until they gutted the shit out of that show. I remember watching the first episode of Nitro live, but thought it was a dirty tactic to have the show on when the WWF was on hiatus. WWE should have stepped in and been more forceful about Raw being put on Monday when they found out about Nitro. Been watching Nitro replays now on the WWE Network, and the show is pretty bad. Later on, I would flip back and forth, but until the NWO started, I barely watched Nitro. It was so bad with the Dungeon of Doom. The highlight for him was Sunny. So, again, just kind of echoing the thoughts there about a pretty shitty product here in the first month or so of Nitro. Again, it's quite interesting to see kind of the dynamic of different viewers here. Didn't really start to watch WCW regularly until the following year, so wasn't aware at the time about the war and its beginnings. I was primarily a WWF viewer in 95. That's from Smelly Meatball from TPWW. I find it's pretty interesting because in giving out feedback, I was actually expecting a lot of kind of split opinions.
With tribalism, obviously, comes out, there's a sort of sense of loyalty, isn't there, that everyone feels. And we've all talked around this table before about how we were, you know, we enjoyed the NWO angle at the time, but we grew up traditionally as WWF guys. It's because that's what we were exposed to, and it's the company that had the name recognition still. So I can understand why a lot of the emails are coming back with that sort of that same starting point of, you know, we watched Raw because that's what you did. That was the pattern. That was for all its problems in 95, it was still at that point the market leader.
So I get to buy tours feedback here from the wrestling forum. He mentions being a kind of, you know, kind of mentioned that he was, you know, a WWF guy, and watching Fall Brawl, where the announcers mentioned Nitro on commentary, and I just assumed they meant the American Gladiator was coming to WCW. That was the first I'd ever heard of Nitro. I learned it was a thing, and I'd catch a few minutes here and there, but I was team WWF all the way. If I thought about it at all in those early months, which I probably didn't, I just assumed WWF would win the Monday Night War rather easily. Again, to echo your thoughts there, Kieran. The illustrious Bill Watts run of WWF ends on October 13th after an apparent disagreement with Vince McMahon over what being in charge constituted. So Watts is gone. I'm guessing there's probably not a whole lot more to stress here other than actually the two things he wanted actually ended up happening for a short period of time at least. The mega push of Ahmed, Brett getting the belt, we'll get to those, I'm sure. But any remaining thoughts on Watts as a eulogy for his WWF run?
No, I liked Ahmed at the start. Good push up to Survivor Series and all that. And
well... yeah.
Well,
I didn't mind Ahmed. I thought he could be a star.
I'm sure if Bill was still there, he might have tried to get Sean fired for the Syracuse incident. But
the same night that Watts quit, outside a bar in Syracuse, Shawn Michaels was involved in a one-sided street fight with several servicemen and pounded into the pavement and hospitalized.
I thought it was 37.
No, it's not, that's not true.
Was it 60? Was it 68?
It was more than that. Actually,
was it 125?
Yeah. I know this is a fact.
Was it half the army?
It was actually, it was the Coast Guard.
It was the 82nd Airborne that did it.
The good news just carries on this week. The Undertaker gets a broken orbital bone thanks to Mabel going for a clothesline on a house show, being too far away and punching him in the face.
No. It happened on Raw in that six-man carnage. That's what Todd Pettenkell telling me on Livewire. You're lying. What makes you lie?
Meltz is wrong. So from October 16th, Chris Benoit pins Eddie Guerrero. This is the match that's on Benoit's DVD where he powerbombs him to death. As far as show quality, Nitro beat Raw by its widest margin to date. So naturally, this is the week where Raw gets the clear ratings win with Bret Hart versus Isaac Yankem in a cage match, doing a 2.5 to Nitro's 2.2. As a fun note here, Hogan did another promo knocking Vince McMahon, saying that Hogan was so powerful he makes other promoters cry when they realise that Hogan is more powerful than their whole stinking promotion, brother. I never thought the guy could get more unbearable, adds Meltzer. Wow. This is just the pattern here with Hogan.
I was going to say, Meltzer says that now, wait till they get to World War III.
Oh yeah, well...
And Hogan had to be convinced to turn heel at this point.
On the note of pay-per-views, October 22nd, In Your House 4... This is a fucking awful show.
This is
Diesel Davey Boy in the main event.
Yeah.
It's the one where they do the fucking horrible bait and switch where they insinuate that Sean's going to defend the belt against Dean Douglas. Even when they knew he wasn't going to.
Yeah, yeah.
They said up till showtime, well, Sean says he wants to go, but the doctors are kind of questioning it. Yeah. And of course, on the pay-per-view, no, you're not getting Shawn Michaels. We're giving the belt to Douglas, who then drops it to Razor. The click wins.
God.
In the interest of full disclosure, this is where I admit to owning on VHS both this show and the King of the Ring 95.
Carl! Tell you what, if anybody deserved to have a pat on the back and a beer talking about this year,
and you laughed at my Best of Uncensored.
I wasn't laughing at the Best of Uncensored, I'm just shocked there was a release.
Phrase is an oxymoron, I think.
But that's showing, you've got Blue Blood, Triple H getting cheered for beating Fatu. You know.
Who's doing it for the kids?
Yeah, Canada clearly didn't think it was time for a change. You've got the smoking guns who just sit on their, where the crowd sit on their hands and cheer. Razor and the 1-2-3 kid, because let's be honest, the other team's the smoking guns. and a match that you...
It's like having two Magnum TAs in one house.
It's too
sweet dreams.
It's two porn moustaches and nothing else. And a match that you omitted from your list there: heel versus heel, Yokozuna versus King Mabel.
Is that on this one? Is that in your house? No, is that this one?
That
no, it is this
that
one,
is on
isn't
that
it?
Show.
Oh God, I forgot about that.
So you've got
Meltzer calls that one of the worst matches of the year, if I'm not mistaken.
You've got, which ends in a double countout. Oh, by the way,
yeah.
You've got possibly
just to really satisfy the fans.
Well, both got beached on the outside. Just stand it now, take it home, folks. Still there at the end of the show. That's like forklifts to get.
Yeah, I think Diesel and Bulldog had to step over them on the way to the ring. But yeah, if it wasn't for the King of the Ring, and even including the King of the Ring that year, potentially the company's worst pay-per-view offering.
Terrible show. On the subject of top babyface being booed, Diesel gets booed here. This is the show where Vince famously throws the headset down as soon as it's finished and says, "Horrible!" when the show is finished. October 30th, Observer. The current plan for World War III is a three-ring battle royal with a giant in each ring. The Giant, aptly named. The Giant Gonzalez with his new gimmick in the Dungeon of Doom as the Yeti. And Ron Reese as T-Rex, who may become the babyface giant. So this is a real fucking rogues gallery of big men here.
The company was full of dinosaurs already. So.
This is just so on the actual October 23rd Nitro, to build up this situation here, Curtis Iaquea did an interview introducing a man in a giant ice cube called the Yeti, who will wind up being Giant Gonzalez, but because Gonzalez is having visa problems, he didn't make it into the country on time. They introduced him without actually being there. Just as the show went off the air, the giant ice cube explodes into a split-second shot of a guy dressed up in a mummy costume. Hulk Hogan did an interview teasing a heel turn by challenging Sting, Savage, and Luger, and running them all down, and then in perhaps the most tasteless line in a long time, showed his black gloves and black cap, saying everyone knows what people in black gloves can do, a reference to OJ Simpson, who had just murdered his wife.
Wow.
Raw the same night, if you want to jump on this, Avatar debuts and blows a ton of spots against Brian Walsh, Al Snow, who had turned down WCW for a WWF offer, has a horrible debut and is quickly, this whole thing is quickly shelved.
Well, it's just amazing then that, like, early on when you were talking about, like, all the names that, like, basically at least one of the companies were fighting over getting, you know, the Eddie Guerreros, the Dean Malenkos, and the Al Snows and so on. It's just amazing that when these guys eventually are used, just how atrociously underused they are, you know, whether they're just lumbered with shit gimmicks or they're not offered great contracts. Or
say what you want about Shane Douglas, but Dean Douglas wasn't helping him at all, was
no,
it?
No, yeah. Not one bit.
I mean, you didn't like those little quips during the SummerSlam pay-per-view?
I did. What was the Razor one? That one was great. I'm not going to use the term bad because that means good. Nothing else on this show of any merit whatsoever, which leads us to Halloween Havoc, speaking of shows with pretty much no merit whatsoever. This is where the Yeti debuts. The 1995 version of a creatively booked pay-per-view containing a man falling off a five-story building to his apparent death, falling into either a river or a parking lot, and then showing up 50 minutes later to wrestle without a scratch or wet hair.
This is after the Battle of Monster Trucks.
Yeah. The Battle of Monster Trucks. Ethan's commentary is quite worthwhile, though, in that whole section.
Oh, yeah.
Kamala quits the company rather than do a job for Randy Savage. That's good stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. The Yeti, who turned out to be Ron Reese, Giant Gonzalez, went AWOL after being hospitalised in midweek after actually getting into the country to do the angle. So moving on to October 30th, the day after Halloween Havoc, Goldust debuts on television, and his ring entrance is impressive, but it's hard to take that costume seriously in the ring. At first, he did look like a giant banana with black ears. Remember that?
Yeah, the black ears thing was strange, and it's one of those where they hadn't quite finalised the costume to an extent,
no.
Had they?
Because they just wanted to look like an Oscar.
Because it wasn't initially that sort of... It didn't have the silver glitter stuff sort of tied in it. It just looked like some cheap yellow jumpsuit.
Yeah, it wasn't a good look.
Yeah, it was like the epitome of what was wrong again with WWF in many ways at the time. It's taking a guy who... They do it so many... Austin as the ringmaster. It was just so many that... giving guys shit gimmicks when I was looking forward to seeing Dustin Rhodes, you know,
WWF,
fresh
guy,
you know, it's like, and you know,
build a bit of a rap in WCW, the stud stable feud, some good stuff.
It was fresh. Let's see what he can do with my company, kind of thing. And then
that gimmick as a 10-year-old kid, that gimmick did freak me out a bit. It was unsettling.
Oh, Kieran,
there was one in the middle of the night where he's overlooking the city, and I'm thinking, jeez, this is eerie, this is creepy.
I actually really like Goldust, I'm not going to lie.
I liked him straight away.
I thought it was a really good... Yeah. It would get better.
But looking back, it was... Wow. It was
brilliant.
It really moved me, so fantastic stuff.
the thing with the Goldust gimmick, though, because it never kind of got me, was... Okay, I like Goldust, but I mean, at the very beginning, was that generally an idea Vincent Mann had? He said, right, I've got a great idea for a character, we just need someone to do it, and he goes, okay, mate, Dustin Rhodes is a good wrestler, we'll have him do it. Or was just another jibe from Vince towards the Rhodes family?
I think that it was a genuine... Because, again, Dean Douglas, I mean, look what they had for guys at the time. This was their mentality. Originally, he was supposed to come in as like a Texas gunslinger type, and then they just kind of, I guess Vince just thought, something more radical was needed. And it's hard, I mean... I don't think he had. I'm not even sure if he really had the gay thing in mind at first, Vince.
No,
to be quite honest,
it didn't have those sort of. It didn't have those homoerotic overtures, did it? Until the Razor feud starts.
Yeah. Just listen to. Okay, Goldust debuts on October 30th. Listen to this fucking. Listen to this fucking card, right? The Smoking Guns versus Phil Apollo and Joe Rashner. This is in the middle of a war. Marty Jannetty versus Joe Dorgan. I'm not making these names up.
This is a phony war. Yeah, historical reference.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the end, the only real notable thing, I guess, if you don't count Goldust, is Ahmed Johnson debuting and slamming Yokozuna, which is actually mentioned as a highlight by a gorgeous Dale Newstead from TPWW forums. Is that, the debut of Ahmed is a real strong point this year.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a good debut and a good start for him.
And it really would have meant something significant had it not been for the fact that we'd seen Luger slam him 2 years previously.
True, but I was impressed because there was only one other guy that did it and he was perceived as a big star, so I immediately saw this as a rite of passage for a guy to care about him at least. Vince McMahon had a surprise meeting with the wrestlers on the November 3rd house show in Cincinnati, apparently to combat poor morale. With the cutting out of the money-losing B house shows, a lot of paranoia has started and some of it is justified. With half as many shows, the mid-card guys for the most part are going to be working a lot less dates and make a lot less money, and for the underneath guys, it will be a lot worse. We're seeing so much effort being placed on Monday night, so much emphasis. Things from a rating perspective are actually heating up on television, but there's a lot of other indicators that aren't actually going so well. House shows tumbled, and pay-per-view buy rates, as we'll come to, did not fare well.
Yeah, I suppose it's that... I know Jim Cornette's talked about this on several podcasts, about this being the hot-shotting era, if you like. And I suppose you've got a situation where if you're seeing these things on TV that you would have only previously seen on house shows, you know, you wouldn't have seen Hogan wrestling on TV, you would have seen it on some of the larger house shows. That doesn't happen now. And you're getting the matches that you would have seen on pay-per-view on TV as well. So it only stands to reason that it's going to have a detrimental effect on other areas of the business. And it's just it's this move away from sort of the traditional setup, which would only sort of get which would only accelerate when the war genuinely started to heat up as you go into 96.
November 6th Observer, in a number that has to send chills down the spine of WWF officials, and actually should for WCW officials as well, the preliminary estimates for the most recent In Your House, this was the dreadful show we referred to with Diesel Bulldog in the main event, range from a 0.35 to a 0.52, huge drops from what would have previously been the worst pay-per-view performance in company history. At the lowest estimate, the show may have actually been the first WWF pay-per-view to be a money loser. So again, just that further point of other indicators not faring well.
Yeah, and it's not exactly a shock when it's a pay-per-view built on a guy in the British Bulldog, with all due respect, that has never really meant anything outside of this country in terms of, you know, hard numbers, and a WWF champion who was the lowest drawing champion in company history before that point, and in the build-up to that pay-per-view is booked with a losing streak gimmick.
Yeah.
Just for anyone who doesn't remember, the superstars before In Your House, he loses by count out to Waylon Mercy.
Ugh.
So, you know, come on, folks. You've just seen the WWF champion lose to Waylon Mercy.
Who had just done a job to Savio Vega previously.
Yeah. So, come on. Pony up the dough for the pay-per-view.
So, it's like we've got this kind of disparity in the almost contradictory nature of the business metrics. But I don't know, is that it's almost like indicated, although the core products themselves were still not great, maybe the excitement over the actual, of what should have gone down on the last show is the greatest feud of all time, WCW versus WWF, the concept of it, maybe that itself was getting over more than the individual products themselves. I don't know.
I don't know if it's worth pointing out at this stage, and anyone can disagree with me on this. You've got to remember, they've broken away from the traditional pay-per-view format as well. You know, we've gone from the previous year in the WWF where there was only 5 pay-per-views to now you've thrown In Your House into the market, and WCW obviously extended the number of pay-per-views before that. So you're oversaturating the market in that regard as well.
Moving on, a couple of interesting notes here. The November 6th episode of Nitro, headlined by Sting and Flair, won the Monday Night Ratings War with a 2.3 to Raw's 2.1. The Raw number is the lowest Raw rating in more than a year, and it was the lowest total wrestling audience on a Monday since this thing began. Yeah. There's that kind of misconception that things immediately were great when the war started, but yeah, the audience has taken a hit here, and it's showing in all the other business metrics. And the ratings here have kind of fallen a little bit too.
Initial intrigue has waned somewhat, and people are still looking at it and thinking, well, there's a bit of intrigue here, but this is still the same crappy product that we've had for the majority of the year.
Wait, it started off
You're setting me up so nicely for the next couple of hours, by the way.
It started off okay, but then, I say, it quickly, as we've seen going through the timeline, it quickly descended into very samey. Yeah, in like the grand scheme of things, from September 4th up till the Scott Hall debut, it's kind of, some of it's like prefacing, and it's a prologue, really, of getting ready for the war, and yeah, to when it really kicked off, so...
That's why I think this kind of period of time is actually really interesting to talk about, because it is, like you said, it's the prologue, and you can see, I mean, ultimately, even though it's the war, it's the same 1995 that there was before. It wasn't this necessary immediate shift, even if they did try some new things at first.
It is. I made the phony war reference before, but it almost was. It was, now it kind of settled down. We've seen the numbers. Not as much going on and back and forth. So, yeah, absolutely, it's... No, I totally agree.
There is a reactionary thing to these ratings here. We mentioned the lowest Raw rating in a year, the lowest wrestling audience on a Monday since this began. November 13th, in an attempt to avoid what has become an inevitable ratings loss when both groups went live head-to-head on Mondays after Survivor Series, WCW will be running Hulk Hogan versus Sting on November 20th in Macon, Georgia. So obviously this is their big dream match that they have not done, Hogan Sting. This is where Hogan has moved to the dark side, if you will. He's all in black, brother. And this is the one that did get played on Worldwide. And I remember seeing it and thinking, wow, this Nitro looks like a big deal.
That was actually, it's funny you mentioned, because that was my earliest memory of Nitro.
Yeah, because
my
we saw it.
My earliest memory of Nitro is seeing the, it's a Sting promo on Worldwide, talking about Hogan and the man he thought was coming aboard and the guy who's changed over the last year.
In an effort to counter the argument that WCW is just, not, you know, 80s WWF ripoff, they bring in the one-man gang, the Warlord and the Barbarian. However... they began taping the New Japan wrestlers on Worldwide to hype the World Cup at Starrcade. Masa Chono, Masa Saito, Koji Kanemoto, Shinjiro Otani, Jushin Thunder Liger, and Kintsugi Sasaki are all brought in. There were problems on the first night of tapings because Kanemoto and Otani were booked to go over the American males, and the males put up a fuss. And a lot of the WCW regulars didn't want to put over the Japanese on television because in most cases they were using submission finishers. So you got this conflict. They're trying to run this angle. I want to mention this here, because it had absolutely no bearing on the Monday Night television, and it was the central angle for their biggest show of the year. Does that not tell you where the priorities lie more than anything else?
Oh, absolutely.
On the November 13th Raw, the main thing was the 1-2-3 Kid Turn. They did a Sid versus Razor, which was originally supposed to be an Intercontinental title match. 1-2-3 Kid Turn's heel, and after they taped the title change, they changed their minds and actually decided, no, this is going to be a non-title match and Razor's still the champion. Sid was very upset after being promised a title and having it pulled from him, and that Hunter Hearst Helmsley will eventually be getting the title from Razor Ramon. This has caused major morale problems because people see it as the Click controlling the championships, and people believe leaving that different rules apply to them than the other wrestlers.
Ooh, foreshadowing.
Indeed.
That also assumes, though, that putting the title on Sid would have been a good idea, so...
Yeah.
And let's be honest, softball season's only around the corner.
Bam Bam Bigelow at this point is being used as a complete stepping stone, jobbing for Isaac Yankem all weekend in prelim bouts. The guy that headlined WrestleMania that same year is losing to Isaac Yankem on the house shows.
Poor Bigelow. Yeah. Things look good for him in 87 and Hogan puts the kibosh on him. His knees go and he's never quite the same worker. Then you get, by the time you get to 95, it's like, job to LT and we'll give you a big push, we promise.
Yeah.
And that big push consisted of that tag main event at King of the Ring,
which also led to Tonka in the main event of a WWF pay-per-view.
Yep, and it's all she wrote.
Ahmed Johnson was apparently over huge at the house shows over the weekend after the Yokozuna body slam, so it did work as a bit of a jumpstart for Ahmed there, Carl. The Survivor Series pay-per-view show is on November the 11th. Bret Hart wins, ending mercifully the reign of Diesel. The title change was more noteworthy in the midst of reports outside the ring, an apparent marketing switch within the WWF to switch gears from aiming to a children's audience to an adult audience. The new character and new attitude of the promotion was set up by Diesel shouting "motherfucker" when he lost the title. So it appears that they believe the ECW approach, or at least a toned down version, is now the most marketable approach in this country, which is funny on a lot of levels. Very much a precursor here, that line.
Very early precursor.
The buy rate drops 37% from the previous year at a 0.57, so things are just not going well at all.
Jesus.
Yeah, ain't good.
I would say on that Survivor Series, on the subject of the ECW remarks, it's the first table break I remember.
It is indeed.
In the company. Yeah. And I thought, because that's another pay-per-view that I had on VHS. I don't know what it is about me and 95 pay-per-views I got on VHS during how terrible a year it was. But I actually thought Survivor Series 95 was a half-decent show.
Yeah, I like that show a lot. Wildcard matches, fun. Underdogs, body dollars.
That's a great opener. Obviously, the one Survivor Series match is just a vehicle for Taker's return and a complete squash of the heel team.
Rightly so at that point.
Oh, absolutely.
You see Lawler's hair on that show.
Oh, God.
You want a Mark Luger, that needs to be mentioned.
Oh, was that the little...
The little quiff at the back of the head. I enjoyed the Diesel Brett match as well.
Yeah, it was a very good match. Okay, so we mentioned that last week they were going to set up Hogan versus Sting for the night after. The title change on the Survivor Series faded into the background less than 24 hours later due to the most important and most daring Monday night battle in the less than 3-month history of the two groups going head-to-head. A battle in which WCW scored the ratings win, but in reality both sides came out as losers because each side threw everything out at once and both ratings were disappointing. WCW put what should have been on paper its ultimate never-before-seen match, Hogan and Sting, to counter the WWF going live. Hogan, who was dressed all in black and played here, was booed out of the Macon Coliseum by the largely papered house of 6,000. However, on Raw, playing off Michaels' legitimate injury, they did the angle where Michaels collapses in the middle of the ring and feigns the brain aneurysm.
Tell me a lie.
People who called the WWF offices the next day were assured that what they saw on television was completely real and not part of the script. Big angle here. Besides that, the other highlight were Diesel taking on a new badass babyface image, blaming Vince McMahon on an interview for creating a fake image of him for the past year. That this is the smiling Diesel. If you don't wear a black glove, I'm not going to acknowledge it. Kind of a promo that he did. Again, setting up that kind of no apologies, kick ass babyface, which we would see later on as well as a blueprint.
I think it might be slightly after. Might not be this week. It was the couple of weeks after was when they did an interview with Sean about. You know, is his career over? And he was like, I don't want it to be, but blah blah blah. And then that's when they foreshadowed of, you're gonna have to retire with never winning the world title and things like that. So just setting the tone for Mania.
Those remarks, I'm sorry, but wait a minute, what a cheap way to get a little remark about Michaels because you got a chub for him down there.
So then in probably trying to rationale this out then, sorry, I'm jumping forwards a bit to 96, but when Hogan, they decide, okay, we're going to actually turn you heel, Hogan, that's what we want to do, and he's at first, if we believe what some people say, that he was against it, because...
He absolutely was.
He was absolutely against turning heel. Was it because of this early kind of trial period where he was all in black and the ratings weren't doing well at all? Was he maybe thinking about that? Thinking we tried something similar to this before and the ratings were shit, so I don't think it's a good idea.
It was just that thing of, in his mind, it was like, I've been this one thing that worked so well forever. It's starting to not work, but is this leap of faith going to be the thing that launches me, or is it going to kill me for good?
Endemic of the whole business. We talk about these guys who have, Savage and Austin, all these guys are kind of, to different degrees, in different respects, kind of stale and need something fresh, and the industry as a whole. So maybe give Hogan a bit of credit for knowing, or whoever came up with the idea, that some kind
dark
of
dark Hogan,
a change,
some
needed.
Kind of
something
fresh
needed. Yeah.
It was probably Mike Graham's idea.
Everything was during that period of time. Bite off in the wrestling forum said for the high points, the post Survivor Series Raw with Michael's collapse and Diesel's shoot. Honestly, I liked most of what WF was putting out at the time. Although as a heel fan, I couldn't stand Michael's, Ahmed, Diesel and Razor, but Brett was finally growing on me. I was actually indifferent to the dreaded King Mabel, although Mo might have been the most worthless guy in the company, and I hated Skip. Even though the WF had overall by far the superior show, WCW won the night, drawing a 2.5 to the WF's 2.3. Neither figure can be considered successful. The Hogan Sting dream match drew a lower number than Flair and Arn in a cage, which shows that even with the best match possible, Hogan has little juice left to have a major impact on ratings. The WWF coming off a pay-per-view, a world title change, and Diesel heel turn tease, doing a 2.3 for a live show is outright disastrous.
No, but overall the figures were rising again, though.
Minimally.
I think if we're talking in terms of trends here, we're saying the figures are stagnant.
Yeah.
They weren't doing good. That's the point. I mean, the whole idea was a massive shock angle. Diesel loses the belt, heel turn. Michaels collapses on live TV. Is he having a stroke? Is he dead? What's going on? Hogan and Sting. I mean, this was completely reactionary booking, and it didn't pay off. I mean, that's the kind of the interesting takeaway there. Also that weekend, Sabu returns to ECW. Sabu never had even signed the WCW contract offered to him, and they were upset with Sabu for a number of reasons. Everybody backstage, wrestlers and management, all thought Sabu wasn't all that he was cracked up to be, and they didn't want him around, so that was the end of that. At the Raw tapings, though, that same day, this is a curious one, Brother Love returns and does an interview with Bret Hart. He talked about winning the title. Again, this is exemplary of the Diesel and Shawn show period of this whole thing. Bob Backlund came out of nowhere and put Hart in the chicken wing and left him laying. Bob Backlund! in 1995. What the hell?
Brother Love as well. For
Christ's sake. He just needed some media coverage for his presidential run.
He did indeed. There's actually a bit more of a story to this.
Coverage by choking out a Canadian.
This is foreign policy.
The renewed battle and push seems to have put some rest concern about the influence of the Click in booking. From reports we received, the Click met with Vince McMahon on the road a few times, and one of the conversations regarded going through the roster person by person and evaluated whether they belonged or whether they should be moved up or down. After the meeting, the guys the Click wanted to see be given a bigger push were still in the same position doing jobs, but the ones they thought were useless and shouldn't have around, Bob Backlund, were now getting a renewed push.
Vince, the pirate's got to go.
That pretty much sums up that discussion. Bigelow and Karma give notice. I'm sure no one particularly was missing them at that point. Bigelow was jobbed out. Karma was never worth anything at that point. The World War III pay-per-view takes place, and there's only a couple of things that really need to be mentioned here. So, Carl, I know you're going to want to talk about Observe This, brother.
Here comes Hulk Hogan, Twisted Firestarter.
One of the weirdest things in the world I've ever seen. Dave Meltzer being called out on pay-per-view, not by name, but the dirt sheets.
This guy's not hurt, though he clearly is.
The whole thing of Savage, you know, the injury being a work, they say Savage isn't really injured. They book the finish to his match to be based around the fact that he does have an injured arm, and then he injures himself worse because he was trying to prove that Meltzer wrong.
And the way he clearly working shows that he was injured. It's so surreal to see. And it comes across as so irrelevant because there's no reaction from the crowd for this, you know, the dirt sheet being burnt in a trash can that's
peels off the black spandex to red and yellow Hogan returns.
Everyone's you watch it back and the crowd, it's background noise. You just hear, it's just like a continuous murmur from the audience thinking, what are we watching?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of Hogan's insecurity about his position playing out on
screen. Imagine
that. I know, but it's quite funny how we're actually seeing him kind of unravel before our very eyes. Also, just because I wanted to mention this, because Brian Alvarez on F4W Online did a show last week covering World War III, and they were wondering why the Yeti in the World War III Battle Royal, the 60-man Battle Royal, came out dressed as a ninja. Do you remember that, Carl?
Carl's dead.
Carl's gone. We actually have the answer here. We've dug it out from mothballs. The original idea here was that they were going to drop the Yeti because it was such a complete disaster.
Wow.
I know. And they were going to repackage him as the giant ninja to be Sonny Ono's bodyguard for this whole New Japan versus WCW thing. They gave him the costume. They forgot to tell them that he's no longer the Yeti. So he just walks out as the Yeti in the giant ninja costume. WCW 101. Left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
This is great. It's, you know what? Yetis aren't working. They're not mythical enough. Ninjas!
No. Giant ninjas.
Giant fucking ninjas. Because that's the epitome of stealth. Fucking 7 foot tall.
The only ninja in Japan over 6 foot, yeah.
What the fuck is he going to hide from?
WCW's estimating a 0.55 buy rate for this pay-per-view. In no way can these figures be considered successful because of Hogan's huge cut at the pay-per-view. And at best, they were doing what they were doing pre-Hogan, and in those days, they didn't have the gigantic payoff either. Here's a funny note about the disorganization in WCW, or where the power really lied. Terry Taylor, the aforementioned Terry Taylor, was in charge of working backstage to get the word to the wrestlers to get eliminated in the Battle Royal. Terry Taylor was given a sheet of paper listing the first 50 eliminations. The final 10 were... The final 10 were called by Hogan in the ring because they wouldn't let the booking committee know the storyline of the finish. There's shock and awe around the table.
Quite amazing. Now, we said at the start this is really foreshadowing the war and WCW and WWF for years to come, but it's kind of more shockingly more than you'd expect, really, to be in net levels. Who went over in that rumble, by the way?
Savage.
Yeah.
Oh, this is actually another great thing that I didn't write down in the notes, but it's in the Observer. Yeah, it's for the belt. The finish was, okay, so you got like Savage and One Man Gang fighting on one side. You got Hogan in the middle, the giant Sting and Luger fighting over there. Hogan eliminates all three in one go because he's Hulk Hogan.
Of course he does, he's Hulk Hogan.
The giant pulls Hogan out from under the bottom rope. Savage eliminates the gang. Referee turns around, sees Savage in the ring, proclaims him the winner. Hogan, in pure Rumble 92 fashion, complains, looks at the crowd and says, am I in the right here? and the fans go, "No,
you're out of here."
Yeah,
no.
Fuck you, Hogan.
Yeah, talk about the Hogan stuff. I'm not sure if it was foreshadowing. It was just again the Hogan hit on the Seattle's face character. But that, on the very first Nitro against Bubba, it's like there's a Jimmy Hart distraction. So who's Hogan's manager? So Hogan can choke out Bubba with his t-shirt. He then does his rake. He rakes his eyes front on in front of the referee. It's like the most blatant heel act.
That's what the fucking heat technique does.
I will say,
he's a heel for 20 years before he turned.
Yeah, the other thing, think about that first show. Nick Patrick looking like Kenny Powers.
I've always thought that. I said that to you longer, didn't I?
Where my love for Nick Patrick ends, because he actually kills that Liger and
Pillman match,
yeah. Yeah, he's horrible.
Concerns me that you had any love for Nick Patrick at any stage prior to that.
Nitro on December the 4th. The main event is Luger versus Savage. Here's a dirty trick for you, as Vincent Mann would say. Before the match started, Bischoff said they had clearance to go past the 1 hour mark, thereby telling everybody ahead of time it would be a long match. The show ended 10 minutes late. By going 10 minutes over, they picked up 0.2 in the ratings. This is the first ever overrun, because they got a quarter hour added onto the good end, as wrestling shows traditionally build audience. That turned out to be the margin at 0.2, because WCW wins 2.6 to 2.4. The bout went 17 minutes, and the WWF received complaints regarding Bret Hart and Diesel using chairs at Survivor Series, and Diesel mouthing "motherfucker." They're trying to do a balancing act between making it a rougher product, but not alienating any of the audience or the sponsors. That isn't going to be easy, says Dave Meltzer. Again, we're noticing the trend here when it comes to Hogan. Nitro on December the 11th. Hogan and Sting versus Flair and Anderson. Hogan was booed out the building again. This time, more than ever, fans in the first few rows that were given Hogan merchandise to wave around in front of the cameras at the end of the show were ripping up the bandanas and throwing them at Hulk Hogan.
Wow.
This, it's a match that's always stuck in my memory. If I'm not mistaken, that Nitro is in the Carolinas.
Right.
So it's smack dab in the middle of Horseman country. And I'm sure there's this bit where Hogan does a bit of a, you know, a bit of a sort of pandering to the crowd. And they just erupt in boos. And then Flair and Anderson turn to the hard camera and stick the four fingers up. And all you see in the hard camera is obviously because you've got the back of them, you just see his arms shooting up with four fingers and they're going ballistic. You know, obviously, I think if I'd have seen that at the time, obviously, like we've said before, we didn't have access to it. But I can't imagine how much that would have boggled my mind as a 10-year-old kid seeing
that.
Yeah,
I don't know, but it was coming, wasn't it? It was coming.
Oh,
from,
yeah,
it was coming from the beginning.
Well, it's coming from WrestleMania 9. So, yeah. So it was always on the cards.
There was a weird Hogan resentment, but as soon as in WCW, especially anytime he was paired against Flair in the Carolinas, how can you not see what's going to happen? This is also the start of the loose cannon era of Brian Pillman from a creative standpoint, is that he did the angle where Mr. Wonderful gets laid out, which Beitel from the Wrestling Forum mentions as his high point. The most memorable 95 moment
was Vader's as well.
When those horsemen jerks took my man Mr. Wonderful out with a spike pile driver. I was all about Mr. Wonderful when 95 came to a close. Bischoff continually watches Raw on a monitor that many fans in the building can see during the live shows, so if he acts distracted, that's why. They once again did the overrun, and they once again won in the ratings. Aja Kong, in one of the stiffest television matches of the year against Chaparita Asari, finishes it off by breaking her nose with a backhand punch. Kong got over great to the live crowd, but appears from the commentary that Vince McMahon isn't sold on this women's deal since he paid little attention to the match. We figure out why 1 week later. The Wild, Nitro vs. Raw, Monday Night Wars, produced another one of wrestling's most memorable moments when Alundra Blaze comes onto Nitro with the WWF women's title belt and throws it in the garbage can. Medusa's contract had expired on December 13th, and it's well known within the WWF that she was negotiating with WCW and they were going to let her go. So when they aired the Aja Kong match, they knew they were scrapping her, the division, and the match at the Rumble 96 between Blaze and Kong that was set up at Survivor Series.
You're referring to the Survivor Series match where if anyone who's still got the cassette or DVD of that, if they go back and watch that match, Alundra Blaze, if I remember rightly, is wearing white attire and it looks as if she shit herself. Go back and watch it. Go back and watch it. There are brown marks. I am not joking.
If I was in there with Aja Kong, I'd probably shit my pants too.
Yeah, I mean, that, now we're actually getting to one of the major points, dumping of the women's title. It wasn't actually like her choice at all to actually throw the title in the bin. She didn't want to do it at all.
No, Bischoff had to talk her into it. And then, in his words, I bet she now wishes she didn't.
Yeah, I know. It's just like, which I was amazed by, because always how I've always seen it and how it's always been promoted to me when I've seen it is that it was like her being like spiteful back to Vince or whatever, but it wasn't.
Absolutely wasn't. She was, I think it had been muted too, and they were going to go ahead, and she got cold feet. And I don't know if maybe Bischoff greased her palm with silver, bit of a pay increase to do it, perhaps. But I will say this in all seriousness, because we criticise or we make fun of WCW, you know, for the inmates running the asylum, and rightly so. This is a company in the WWF that knew when her contract expired, knew she was in negotiations with WCW, but was still at the time promoting a singles match for the women's title at the Rumble.
Yeah, well,
it's just
and put the match with her challenger on TV, even though they knew they were going to let her go.
Yeah, it just, you know, fair is fair. We criticised WCW for it, but geez, Vince isn't exempt from these moments of stupidity.
Well, that's the thing. For Vince, again, we get a lot of this now. That whole the talk about Vince being out of touch. I don't think he realised just how hungry Bischoff was to fuck him. Because this whole thing started with Luger, keep in mind. I mean, this wasn't the first time.
This whole war is Bischoff.
This whole war is Bischoff. So that's why you're probably noticing there's a lot more WCW talk here than WWF, because it's Bischoff who's on the aggressive. Yeah.
I mean, I think Vince said a few times, well, it could be rewriting history as they are wont to do, but he articulates that his theory at the time was that they're going to burn themselves out, and it's going to be a war of attrition, so just stay the course and do your thing, which the facts don't really back that up in terms of their own hotshotting.
But the WWF's In Your House 5 pay-per-view is here on December 17th. This is in, I believe, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Carl, you'll probably remember that off the top of your head. Bret Hart Blade, which again, WWF tries to claim they didn't know about, but it's insinuated this is part of their rougher edge going back to the Blade. Bit of blood on pay-per-view to kind of... And again, it's Pennsylvania. Maybe they're trying to appeal to some of that kind of...
Yeah, possibly. And in fairness, because I've been very negative on the Bulldog in this podcast. In fairness, he holds up his end of the bargain.
That's a very good match.
It's a really good match.
Really good match. This show was fucking horrible as well. With the exception of the Bret-Davey match, this pay-per-view has got very little going for it. And unfortunately, poor Bulldog's taking a dig in here, because the In Your House 5 buy rate was an estimated 76,000 buys. It would be the fewest pay-per-view buys of any pay-per-view in history to date for the WWF.
Well...
76,000 buys.
Yeah. The problem is, you've got, as you say, you know, I give Bulldog praise there, but he doesn't really mean anything outside of this country, let's be honest. And you've got to look at the rest of the card. Henry O. Godwin against Triple H in a hog pen match. You've got, what is it, Marty and
Razor against Sid and
the Kid. Sid and the 1-2-3 Kid, which is the start to the Goldust feud.
Yeah.
Because when Razor goes to do his all sort of pointing to the chest and fireworks display, it glitters gold from the crowd. From the ceiling, rather. And then you've got the blow-off to the Undertaker-Mabel
match. Which
no one cared about in the first place. Not to forget the Ahmed Johnson attack by Jeff Jarrett.
And Buddy Landell getting a bashing.
Buddy Landell shit-kicking at the hands of Ahmed Johnson. And let's not forget, last but by no means least, Santa Claus.
I was going to mention him. He debuted on the pay-per-view, a heel Santa Claus who attacks Savio Vega. He appeared on Raw the next night. Did he ever appear again? I don't think he did.
He appeared once on Raw and once on an episode of Superstars.
And that was the end.
And that was it.
So by the time he appeared in WWF Magazine, he must have been done with the company then on screen, I'm guessing?
You would imagine. You'd assume so, yeah.
Yeah. Among those who were backstage at the pay-per-view were Steve Austin, who debuted at the Raw tapings as the Ringmaster the next night and given the $1 million belt using the sleeper as a finisher. Again, kind of in the Goldust mode of trying to, you know, paint somebody in new colours. But the December 18th episode of Nitro...
Did they even want to get guys over? You know?
The Dean, the Ringmaster. Like, yeah.
It's one of those, you can picture it, can't you? You can picture Jim Ross, the same with Foley after that. He's gone to Vince and said, you should get this guy. Oh yeah, okay. Then, you know, a week later, why have we got this guy again?
Who the fuck signed Raven?
December 18th, Nitro sets his all-time head-to-head record this week with a 2.7, headlined by Randy Savage defending his newly won title against the Giant. Despite coming off the pay-per-view and being alive, Raw once again faltered to a 2.3. So these post-pay-per-view bumps are not working out in the WWF's favour here. December... Okay, also I should note, on the go-home Nitro, they didn't mention New Japan at all for Starrcade 95. I mean, just absolutely no promotion at all. There's talk about the triangle match that we're going to do with Flair, Luger and Sting, but I mean, absolutely nothing for anything else. And we'll see how that works out, ladies and gentlemen.
Sure we will.
Starrcade 95, Ric Flair wins the WCW title, a decision made by Hulk Hogan. A weird show and a strange combination of old and new. The WCW officials were so happy with the undercard that Sonny Ono and Masa Saito negotiated the next day and came to an agreement to use Japanese talent more often on pay-per-views in 96, and also to do a World Cup again next year, which, by the way, did not happen, yeah. But for different reasons. Interesting, though, that this kind of served as a precursor for Bischoff thinking these guys will be very, very handy, these New Japan wrestlers and Japanese talent in general. It should be noted, Hogan's not on this pay-per-view, and they really anchor the whole show around Flair. And you know, again, Flair,
how did it do ratings wise? Well, buy rate, sorry.
Well,
let's
Starrcade did 83,000 buys, the second lowest buy rate in company history. So that's what you get when you don't promote the fucking matches that you're going to put on the pay-per-view, and you don't announce the card on your go-home show.
I bet Hogan used that as an excuse.
I'm sure he did. Well, and that's the thing. It's like they Hogan wasn't there. They used Flair, Savage, Luger, and Sting to anchor the whole thing. They probably didn't give two shits about the rest of the card, to be quite honest. Even if it's the theme of the pay-per-view, that's their mentality. The big guys will carry it. On the undercard, we'll just have a novelty little thing to fill. Again, because, I mean, if Hogan's not there and those guys are all together, what else have you got for that undercard at the time? Hard Body Harrison v. Alex Wright or something like that? I mean, so Starrcade is a flop. In Your House 5 is a flop. The Final Observer of 1995 has a lot of interesting things here. In an effort to combat falling buy rates, the WWF has sent out for many surprising names for the Royal Rumble in January. Among those known to have been contacted for the event are Dan Severn, Jake Roberts, Ultimate Warrior, Big Van Vader, and Rick Martel. Of those names, the only name that's been mentioned at all on television is the Ultimate Warrior, although Vince McMahon, in negotiating with people, did mention Vader and Warrior as appearing in the Rumble. Vader, of course, would. Ultimate Warrior would take until WrestleMania to come. There's a big dispute about money and silliness like that. Warrior having...
And Jake would as well.
Jake was in the Rumble.
But I'm sure that... Obviously, once they ironed out the kinks, it was smooth sailing through calm seas for Warrior and Vince.
It always was. Razor Ramon is complaining long and loud about his program with Goldust. Sean and Razor hate the gimmick, and unfortunately have taken it on Dustin Rhodes. Ramon is trying to get the program switched to working with... Triple H for the Intercontinental Championship. This is where Razor gets the nickname backstage of Razor the Moan, because he'll do nothing but bitch backstage about how shit his pay is for 95 and how he doesn't like what he's doing. The biggest story, this is what Meltzer says, the biggest story as we end 95 and go into 96 is the Monday Night Wars and the changes in wrestling that have come from these wars. The fact that Nitro became the highest rated weekly show on TNT and the Saturday Night TBS numbers are going through their seasonal growth period leaves WCW filled with momentum, which, again, we mentioned 8 weeks earlier, wasn't looking like it was the case. The WWF is a lot shakier. Who in August would have believed that by the end of the year it would be the WWF acknowledging that it may have to move its flagship Monday Night Raw that was coming off the most successful quarter in history to a different night? Which Vince McMahon had said in interviews. After 7 years in business and an estimated $30 million in losses, WCW finally turns its first profit in 1995, albeit a small one. In the 15 weeks of head-to-head battles, Raw averaged a 2.43 to Nitro's 2.39, but from a purely ratings perspective, Nitro won 7 of these weeks, Raw won 6, and 2 were tied. By any standard, Nitro has won the last 3 weeks in a row. So again, it's very split at this point.
What's incredible, straight away, I'd say 3 months in, but really it was probably week one on September 11th, was how the business was turned so short-sighted so quickly.
Fast.
Unbelievable.
Pay-per-view buy rate's not even a priority at this point, and they're tanking seriously.
Mine's just speculating. So basically, just going from those numbers then, is it fair to say that December then is the worst month for buy rates that ever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was awful.
The thing is, and I'm glad that metrics has been mentioned several times as it was the word that I couldn't remember. Thanks, guys. Way to have my back there. But it's very much to Kieran's earlier point. It's the phony war where they're sort of, you know, they're jockeying for position, and it's a very murky picture, like you say.
Not even that much has changed. I said those numbers, and it's pretty close, really. But it seems like it's the end of the world already, isn't it?
Yeah, and you talk about the sort of the drastic change in sort of in temperament, perhaps, and sort of, you know, vision going forward. And I think it probably stems from the fact that, as we've said, you've got Bischoff, who is very much the antagonist. in this role, who's doing anything he can to stick it to Vince, and in particular to come out on top on the Monday nights. You've already mentioned about the overruns there, and as we know from previous DVDs and things of that nature, that they gimmicked the quarter hour ratings because they wanted to beat them to break, so that the ratings went in their favour. And then on the other side of that, you've got Vince, who's in somewhat of a panic mode. You know, he's meetings with the wrestlers. He's brought Bill Watts in. Bill Watts has gone. They're looking towards going towards this edgier sort of style,
but at the same time, back
and they're still bringing in people like Santa Claus. Austin's coming in as the ringmaster. You know,
real duality.
Yeah, it's very much not to sort of try and tie it back to my little intro bit, but in '95, the WWF are throwing shit at the wall. And nothing is sticking.
No, nothing at all. Just to get some final feedback here, the It Factor from Wrestling Forum says, "Man, this may sound crazy, but I was young at the time. I never really got the impression of a war during '95. Maybe because the internet wasn't big and it wouldn't be pushed like that. But I just saw it as two wrestling shows on TV at a night when wrestling shows are on. That's just how it felt to me. I also hated WCW and I couldn't tell you why. Other than my favourite wrestler at the time was Shawn Michaels, who was a through and through WWF guy. I also had this mindset that WCW was where old stars go to fade out. Obviously, it didn't end up that way by the end of '96, but that's what it always felt like to me. As someone who had just started watching around early '93, there was legitimately no one I cared about that jumped ship before or during '95. I just didn't think that WCW was captivating wrestling."
Ah, that's a good point. I'm probably, yeah, close to my, even down to the Shawn Michaels line, probably close to how I felt at the time as well. Yeah, just total. It WCW felt like, as UK fans will be familiar with this, and I assume it's similar in America and elsewhere in the world, a lot of indie shows in the '90s and even in the 2000s would run guys with like a fake Earthquake or a fake Undertaker is the perfect example of one. It kind of felt, watching WCW, it's like that. It was
the Legend of Doom on these.
It was almost like a Legends tribute show. Yeah, so it's a tribute show, so it wasn't a serious contender. It was the enemy at the time. That's how I felt about it. Yeah,
I get a lot of the feedback here, like I said, is very WWF centric in many ways. In B. Gillette 86 from F4W Online, "In 95 I was a much bigger fan of the WWF than I was WCW. I would watch Raw and flip to Nitro during commercials or boring segments. I really thought WCW Saturday Night was a superior show to Nitro anyway, because that's where most of the storylines were progressed, as opposed to Nitro." So we've got a lot of, I mean, we've run the gamut here on feedback. We've talked about 995 in depth. Final thoughts around the table about what this 4 months of the Monday Night War kind of teaches us, because again, these are kind of the last months, and people have this assumption that the Monday Night War, yeah, as soon as it, you know, started, it set wrestling on fire. Not the case.
No, it's a much more sort of shades of grey world, if you like. And I think a word we've mentioned a couple of times when we've gone over old ground there is precursor. 95 is the precursor to everything. It's sort of like like Kieran said, it's the phony war. You've effectively loaded up the cannon, everything's ready to go, but you haven't lit the fuse yet.
Yeah,
I just think the great Eric Bischoff deserves a little credit for giving us, or at least fermenting, the most exciting period in wrestling history.
Oh, absolutely, he deserves all the credit.
I mean, I said I've got the theory that once they went to the war, there only could be one winner. But we got 5 great years. Well, 4 great years. Well,
depends what you're watching.
But it changed the business, and it for better and for worse. Well, yeah, for better and for worse, really. So it took it to heights that it would never get to again. And but irreversible damage as well. He was ballsy, goddamn, he was gutsy, he was his little bulldog.
It's funny reading about this time and the way the ratings went, because there's so much of this kind of perception in people's minds that WCW was down here, the WWF was up here, and the Monday Night War really helped change things. One of the things that's often forgotten is that the Monday Night War was competed on WCW's turf. They always had the leading cable ratings over the WWF. The WWF's TV strength was in syndication, which was actually becoming a dying thing because cable was going to end up being the big thing anyway. This war was fought on WCW's turf, where Saturday Night was always had a strong presence, dating back to the Superstation, yeah, with Ted Turner. It probably shouldn't be as much of a surprise as it was. Again, we read the feedback from people who were watching at the time. We read what Dave Meltzer said about what was, the consensus in the industry was. People thought this was suicide. As it turned out, the WCW, I mean, the WCW, it sounded like Bret Hart, WCW came out looking great. When in reality, their buy rates were down. They weren't even running house shows at this point because they couldn't draw. But Nitro's reigns, which they, you know, cable reigns, which were already, they were strong with, just they got like that kind of credibility boost that maybe they didn't have before.
Yeah, that's true. And the thing is, and you mentioned earlier about when the war started, eventually one of them was gonna bite the dust. One of the companies would probably die. But it's the fact that rather than it be a foregone conclusion that this war is going to start and WCW are going to die, at that point in time, we know what happened in retrospect, but at that point in time, it's not clear at all who the winner's going to be in this war.
No.
It's not clear at all. Like I say, it's a murky picture, and WCW, to your point, has far more credibility coming out of 95, despite the sort of the damage to business metrics. It's got much more credibility coming out of 95 than it had going in.
You mentioned, like, obviously, you know, what Bischoff was doing at the time, and also, you know, that they did win in percentage more ratings than Raw did. But to me, listen to this, and I'm going the back and forth between everyone. This just comes across as a fight in a playground. Yes, they there was a little bit of hint of what they were doing with Hogan, but they didn't cash that in until quite, you know, good distance into 96. There's apparently this, you know, Vince McMahon saying we're going to have a bit of an edgy, you know, edge, yeah, an edgy and edge to our business. But that didn't really come about, really, until 97, and at the earliest.
It's context again, though, because in both the Hogan thing and the Attitude era in WWF, it's... they weren't things you just click your fingers and do it. There was a fear factor to both things. You know, at the end of the day, Hogan was... they had a lot invested, they had everything invested in Hogan. Mm. And what if that failed? You completely fuck it. You fucked yourself. WWF, if they, you start saying motherfucker on every show, and all your sponsors jump ship, then you...
and you don't get anything in return.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you draw a five, if you've got no sponsor, you're making no money, you get thrown off the air, you lose the war. So it was still a fear factor involved in that, and all the way through. So
that's absolutely fair. It's why I use the analogy of the two kids just calling each other names, because it's just like neither one of them, both sides are too afraid to go too out there to attack the other guys. They're just doing pot shots at the moment. They're not going, like, because if you know, if Vince McMahon was kind of really worried about the product and what they were doing, and like Diesel's not working, and like, okay, WCW like doing something dodgy right now, we're gonna have a new edgier attitude. If he wanted to, he could have gone a lot faster with that edgy attitude than what he actually did. And if WCW were really going for the jugular, there's a lot of things that they could have done a lot sooner, but they didn't. They both took their time doing it.
But it's risk reward. What if it doesn't work out? Then you've lost yourself. So it's
exactly. They're both afraid of throwing that first punch. That's why they're just name calling at the moment.
A lot picked up very, very early in 96. But if you like this format for this show, then we can talk about that another time. So drop us a line at scgradio@hotmail.com and let us know that you like this, and we'll get to it. So I would like to thank everybody for all the feedback. If we didn't get to it this time, I apologise. There's a lot to discuss, a lot to talk about. For Kieran O'Rourke.
Kindly.
For Carl Jones.
Peace.
And for G. John Chase.
I'm so glad we didn't talk about Mantar.
I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.